Hey, Adam.
Hi, Alex. And hello, everyone. Yes. Welcome to Liver Talks, the Liver Fellow Network podcast. We have a
barn burner.
Really tremendous show.
It's our favorite
today.
Week of the year, the liver meeting.
Yeah, yes, it is. I thought you were going to say Thanksgiving.
Indeed.
Before that.
It's here this week.
It's coming.
And we can't wait. Sad that it's not in person, although, as you've mentioned before on this podcast, slightly less sad that it's not in person since it was going to be in Anaheim. But we look forward to in-person meetings again someday.
Yeah, apologies for all the Anaheim stands out there. It's a flight for us, you know.
Well, anyway, we have a really great show today. As the title would suggest, we have the president himself on the show today. It is a wide-ranging conversation, everything from how he got into liver, advice for trainees that are interested in liver, and then a lot of discussion around workforce issues, disparities in liver medicine, both on the patient and provider side, and then a discussion of the future of hepatology too. So there's something in there for everybody. Skip around if you'd like, or listen to the whole thing would be ideal. But hopefully you enjoy it. And then in the last segment, we're mainly going to be talking about a panel that Adam is on at the liver meeting that I think should be of significant interest to almost everybody that's listening to this about the application for your transplant hepatology year or advanced hepatology year. And then we'll talk for a minute or two about my poster at the liver meeting. But hopefully you guys can digitally stop by it this year.
Yeah. So stay tuned. Up next, Dr. Raymond Chung.
Today, we are honored to have true liver royalty on the podcast in the form of Dr. Raymond Chung, a man who needs no introduction, but I will give one anyway. He is the director of hepatology in the Liver Center, vice chief of gastroenterology, and the Kevin and Polly Maroney research scholar at Massachusetts General Hospital. And he's also currently serving as the president of the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases. And we are thrilled to have him on the podcast for our special liver meeting podcast. Dr. Chung, welcome.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation for this wonderful forum that you've created.
Well, thanks. So we'll jump right in. So a lot of our listeners, we think, are trainees that are interested or considering a career in either advanced or transplant hepatology. And so we thought we might just start by hearing a little bit about how your interest in hepatology developed and any advice you have for those people considering a career in liver disease.
Yeah, you know, mine was a slowly developing kind of a career path. This was not a eureka aha moment. Early on in my career progression, I throughout residency was trying to sort out what I might be interested in, and my two interests actually at the time were infectious diseases and oncology of all things, and I found myself in the middle of residency finding myself downtrodden by the continued morbidity and mortality that we were facing with the AIDS epidemic at the time, and in dealing with very sick patients entering the bone marrow transplant unit where I did so much of my inpatient oncology, that I came out of that with a little sense of despair that I was entering or having interest in fields that had little hope at the time, So I did a little bit of a pivot to try to find a field where there was much more in the way of the opportunity to make a difference in outcomes in patient populations, and GI kind of came to me as a possible fit, and interestingly, I found that my mesh with the personalities of those in GI seemed to be quite simpatico. So I entered GI and then found that the liver was really where it was at for so many different reasons, and not the least of which was the ability to reach back and go back to my original themes of infectious diseases and oncology to study what was at the time hepatitis non-A, non-B, and recently christened as hepatitis C through that impactful discovery back at the beginning of my training. And as well, you know, to, you know, realize that that chronic liver disease was a significant, the most important cause or most important etiology of liver cancer. Mm-hmm. And so so between, I think, those two entities and the liver and its unique complexity, there was plenty of work to do in that specific part of the body and part of the GI tract, and I really became extraordinarily interested in the pathophysiology and as well, of course, the specific disease entities. In terms of those who are considering liver disease as a career, I would say that you know, the liver needs no introduction as being central to life, right? We've been able to recapitulate or substitute for the function of just about every other organ in the body, but still cannot do the same for the liver.
Right.
Save for a transplanted organ. There are no dialysis modalities, even try as we have over decades to recapitulate all of its myriad functions, and that I think is such an intrinsically appealing notion that we are dealing with such a critical organ, and you know, but it offers so much richness from the vantage point of the study of multiple processes, including the aforementioned viral, but also metabolic, autoimmune, genetic, mm-hmm. toxic. All of these processes converge to exert their pathophysiology in the liver, and the liver, of course, is you know, a grand central station in terms of interactions with signals from elsewhere in the body, gut liver interactions, and the interaction of the liver with both intestinal microbiome, but as well even signaling molecules that may in fact derive from the microbiome, both hormonal and other signaling entities like bile acids, all I think have very much a interface with the liver. And then of course you've got other pathophysiologic processes, including, you know, fibrosis and fibrogenesis, inflammation, and of course carcinogenesis, as we discussed earlier. The liver also affords you the ability in patients with end-stage liver disease to study the intersection of you know, decompensated liver disease with other extrahepatic organ system complications: the kidney, the lungs, the heart, the central nervous system, to name several. So the study of the liver is the study of medicine, and the study of
there it is.
You know, of the entire sort of, you know, multi-system functioning of the body, and so it is uniquely you know, positioned both clinically and from a research vantage point to be, I think, extraordinarily appealing and impactful.
There it is. What other reasons would you need to enter this field?
Yeah.
We wanted to ask you, since you've been serving as president of ASLD for the last year, and Alex and I don't know, and I'm sure a lot of our listenership doesn't know, what are the responsibilities of the president of the ASLD, and how do you fit that work into what we're presuming is an already extremely busy day and week for yourself?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Adam. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, it may seem like a responsibility in a job, and I suppose, you know, as a fundamental descriptor, it is, but to me, it's, you know, it's the ultimate honor and capstone of a, you know, really the recognition of a career studying and dedicating oneself to the diseases of the liver and the care of patients with liver disease, and so the whole idea of volunteering for a position like this is really no work at all. It's absolutely the joy of being able to give back to the field that really gave rise to, you know, my career and anything that came from it in terms of recognition. And really, to, you know, be able to give back and have an influence, a multiplier effect, if you will, on many others who are either in it or entering the field. And so I think that it's really, it's taking the kind of supervision and mentorship that I provide locally in my own institution and really, you know, extending that out onto a considerably broader platform. And I think that has been just an absolute joy. And this is true of anyone who volunteers for the organization. And we have hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers who are participating in their own way to enhance the life of hepatologists, both in this country and throughout the world. And you know, by participating in committees or in special interest groups, by contributing content to programming, to helping to organize, symposia, webinars, conferences like emerging topic conferences, to even grassroots efforts with regard to our interactions with our patients, to being involved in advocacy, Liver Capitol Hill Day, to promote causes in Congress that are really near and dear to both clinicians and researchers who take care of patients with liver disease. I mean, all of these contributions that ASLD members make are really, they give back in multiples to many others in the field. So it is an absolute joy to do this. Now, how does it get done? It gets done really, honestly, through an extraordinary organization itself, an organization composed of really principally staff who really make this all work. And these are full-time professional staff working at the association who are completely have bought into the mission of the organization to prevent and cure liver disease, who really carry out the agenda that has been laid out by the volunteer leadership of the organization. And so if you can imagine, as a board, for instance, we meet and we set the course and the policy and the strategic objectives and planning for the organization, and they carry out on the ground execution of that mission. And in many ways, it's almost utopia because we come up with these ideas and the volunteer staff, or I should say the professional staff at ASLD, enacts those ideas. They bring those ideas very much to life. And if we could have that happen in our day jobs, we'd be truly, truly productive individuals. But so in many ways, this year has been so, packed with the ability to have an impact in so many different domains because of the staff that is fully dedicated to making those ideas realized. So it's just a marvel to watch, and incredibly rewarding to just say that these ideas set into motion actually had a visible kind of a payoff and impact, and so it's really been a joy. It really has been a career highlight to be able to have that kind of influence on an organization.
That's great. Hopefully you'll be able to get some sleep during the liver meeting. I'm not sure how many responsibilities you'll have during that.
I'll do my best.
Yeah. Shifting gears just a little bit, we've had Oren Fix on this show previously talking about the growing workforce crisis facing hepatology and projected ongoing increases in patients that would benefit from specialized liver care, and how we probably don't have enough people being trained in practice of liver disease. And obviously the Emerging Liver Scholars Program through ASLD and the integrated fellowships have attempted to promote this interest in pursuing a career in hepatology and make it really slightly or a bit easier in terms of shortening the length of training and also trying to get residents involved. Any other interventions or programs that currently exist or in the pipeline that you think will be particularly impactful, or any ideas that that have come up to try to help grow the workforce?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Adam. I think that as you already alluded to, I mean, we're certainly doing everything we can to promote interest on the part of young trainees. And so you cited the Emerging Liver Scholars program, which has been a crown jewel display of the kinds of impact we can have on young trainees who really catch the hepatology bug by being introduced to the liver meeting at a young and impressionable stage of their training, and you know, the kind of return on investment, if you will, for that kind of program has been extraordinary in terms of the numbers of individuals who have returned to become, have chosen hepatology and themselves, in fact, returned to become ambassadors for the ELS program and really sort of, you know, paid it forward to see others join in. But, you know, we can't stop there, as you suggested. We've expanded, at some level, that ELS program to other phenotypes as well. So, for instance, we've added an advanced practice provider category for the ELS to recognize a number of them and to get them turned on to hepatology as a career. And in fact, more broadly, we've directed, I think, an enormous amount of our programming at the liver meeting and outside of it toward our APP groups, because we realize, of course, as providers of liver care, they represent a significant ability to at least make a dent on the care needs of patients with liver disease out there. But, you know, I think even beyond the APPs, who are still, if you will, specialists, we're going to have to go even further, and to meet the needs of patients with liver disease, we're going to have to get out there and cross train even non-hepatologists, non-APP hepatologists, and this would of course include our colleagues who are primary care providers and internists, to really get involved in the early steps of recognition and possibly even stratification of disease risk for conditions like NAFLD and NASH and certainly viral hepatitis in terms of screening and hopefully getting those patients plugged into care quickly. And in fact, this includes cross training, as we have with our infectious disease colleagues, to learn the principles of treatment of certainly hepatitis C and really hepatitis B as well, and I think extending that even into some of our primary care populations, where risk factors exist perhaps in certain quarters, would be particularly important to train our substance use disorder clinics, for instance, and our clinicians, you know, to get involved in recognition and treatment of those conditions. But even, as I suggested, internists, particularly those who take care of diabetics and obese patients, certain ethnic groups, I think we're going to need to embed not just a curriculum, but even initiatives like embedding tools, non-invasive instruments like transient elastography or other tools into those clinics to actually begin to start making early diagnoses of fatty liver and even fibrosis, for that matter, to begin to again stratify these patients for particular need for more intensive follow-up with specialists. So I think that we're going to have to work at all of these angles, at the education end and really empowering those on the ground who are actually seeing these patients, to recognize them and then again stratify those who need further care in to see specialists where it's needed.
Yeah, another thing we've talked about with a bunch of different guests this year, and another crisis in our field, is that of disparities, and we've looked at it from two very different angles. One is the disparities that our patients face with increasing data and evidence that patients from minoritized communities have significantly worse outcomes from liver-related disease. And at the same time, we also have a real disparity from a provider perspective with very few hepatologists from URIM backgrounds. And so our next few questions are sort of aimed at that. And the first is, you know, a lot of the research thus far has been around identifying a lot of these disparities for our patients. And as we start to transition towards initiatives that may help to sort of narrow or ideally eliminate these health disparities for our patients, are there specific ones that you're most excited about or think might be most effective?
Yes, I may have alluded to some of those, I think, just a moment ago, which would really be, again, getting education out to community health centers and community practices in terms of really identifying truly treatable conditions here. And so this would be, in keeping with the World Health Organization's a challenge to eliminate viral hepatitis by 2030. This would involve screening and identification of those with viral hepatitis. There is, clearly a recommendation for all adults now to be screened for hepatitis C. We need to enforce that, we need to do the same thing in terms of really assuring that every adult is vaccinated for hepatitis B, and certainly that would involve understanding whether those patients either harbor Hep B or are immune to hepatitis B. So each of these initiatives, I think, need to be enforced in all communities, but particularly in communities where those risks exist, and where there are certainly healthcare disparities in terms of access. We're going to need to train the folks on the ground who are actually seeing these patients where they are. The same can be said again for fatty liver disease. I think that embedding care and remote training of those caregivers in those communities becomes critical. And so this can be done through electronic curricula, through video conferencing, like ECHO programs, for instance, may be an example of that, particularly for far-flung locations. But again, also embedding technologies, whether non-invasive testing like simple FIB-4s or NAFLD fibrosis scores, but also even FibroScan transelastography in these high-risk communities. There are a number of examples, I think, among several centers, and certainly our center has been very interested in embedding not just care providers, specialists in our community health centers, but also even the technology like elastography to identify those patients. These, we think, will help us take steps to reduce some of those disparities, both at the level of patients, patient populations, as well as certainly from the vantage point of identifying those patients in communities where there are disproportionate frequencies of these liver conditions.
And then, obviously, we've talked a lot about the workforce already, but with the goal of trying to have the hepatologists better represent the patient population that we're actually treating, are there certain ways that either in the programs we've already sort of talked about or in other ways that we can proactively push to have a more diverse hepatology workforce?
Yeah, this is another really important question, Alex. We talked a little bit about ELS and some of those initiatives at the resident level to get folks interested in hepatology. These are folks who are already MDs, and these are folks who had already entered medical school. I think we have to start even more proximally than that. And I think we need to plant the seeds of interest in underrepresented minorities before they even make the decision to apply to medical school. So I think, even as far back as the undergraduate level, certainly at the medical student level, even, we can begin to, plant those seeds of interest in hepatology and in liver diseases. And here I think these can be not just initiatives like attending the liver meeting, but I think you know, getting involved in projects with a hepatology mentor. And this can be a summer project for a for a student, an undergraduate student, or a medical student from an underrepresented minority. I think it's going to be critically important again for the for the bug to start really early with it's never too early, quite honestly. Now I think that is a so that's the pipeline level, you know, to enhance the pipeline of URM candidates who then become committed to the care of patients with liver disease. But I also think that you know, even those who are within our fields, you know, those URMs within the field, I think will benefit from real you know, mentorship to you know, to again, not just be taught how to become a center of excellence or to expand their practice in a community, you know, that they want to serve, but even to become, you know, leaders within the organization or within the field, to really people the field with real role models. I mean, role models that themselves can, you know, inspire others. You know, just through their visibility, to emulate them, right? And so, so it's you know, it's building up these individuals to assume higher profiles, so that you can again benefit potentially from a multiplier effect there, and so we'll have to work it at all ends, the supply side, the pipeline end, but also take what's already in the system and coach it up. And give them a higher profile and impact.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then for our trainee audience, if there are people that are very interested in, from a scholarly perspective, in pursuing work related to disparities in liver disease, are there either programs or resources through ASLD that you could point them to?
Yes, absolutely. And glad you brought that up. So, for instance, we have committed to, we've first of all created a new abstract category around disparities for the liver meeting. And I think that's an important recognition of the ascendancy and the criticality of this area generally. We also have buttressed that with abstract research awards. Travel awards, for instance, particularly travel awards when we actually go in person to the meeting, but abstract research awards that will recognize meritorious abstracts in that area of disparities research. We're also recognizing and funding disparities research in the form of our some of our clinical research awards. Our clinical translational out and outcomes research award includes a category around disparities as well. And so, and you may even we may even soon see, and this is all the work of our ASLD Foundation, work in developing potentially even a specific grant award category soon. So I think it, you know, we're working at as many ends as we can to recognize the importance of studying this question, and recognizing it as a legitimate field in its own right.
Shifting gears, you are the president, our president, and we imagine that by virtue of being sitting on top of this, you know, massive organization, that you probably have a unique vantage point looking at our beloved field of hepatology. And so we wanted to sort of pick your brain about your thoughts on the future of the field. And so the first question we have is, in terms of innovations that you actually think will change management for patients with liver disease that are close, that are actually realistic in the next few years, which ones are you sort of most excited about?
Yeah, you know, there are a number of clearly disease areas that are exciting for the kinds of therapeutics that are being developed. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. examples of that, of course, include, you know, the pivot from the curative regimens for hepatitis C to hepatitis B, and very legitimate attempts to increase the functional cure rates of Hep B. Mm-hmm. The same can be said, of course, for NAFLD, where dozens of agents are entering deeper and deeper clinical trials, and we're going to see exciting mechanisms of action being leveraged in those patients. But with that excitement all there, to be sure, I think in terms of answering your question, you know, what I think will be most exciting in all this will be, I think, the ability to customize or to individualize the management of our patients by doing a better job of phenotyping them. And this phenotyping comes in many forms, including classical clinical data, buttressed by other perhaps more omics-based data, including genomic data, proteomic, metabolomic, and even transcriptomic data. And non-invasive markers like circulating markers to really give more precision to that patient's phenotype. And so, you know, a case in point might be fatty liver disease, which is an extraordinarily heterogeneous disorder, and likely many different disorders kind of rolled into one giant umbrella term. And I think that one of the reasons that clinical trials thus far have been somewhat less than robust in their impact and outcome may be the fact that we're lumping so many different subgroups together and so diluting the effect of any given, say, you know, mechanism that's being applied. And so I think what we need to do is perhaps better match our patients to the therapeutic class that is being offered there, and so we may very well find, based on those those omics tools, we may find that a certain pathway needs to be drugged or blocked as compared to other pathways, and I think this will allow us to potentially begin to think about specific enrollments of patients into specific pathway trials that would potentially yield far more productive results and possibly result in, I think, again, a more customized approach to the management of those patients. And so I think that you know, this is true, I think, for fatty liver disease, to be sure, but may also be true for other conditions as well. I think the use of you know, to the point about using other tools, other technologies, artificial intelligence, I think figures into this as well. So not just the omics sort of revolution, but the AI revolution may also improve our ability, particularly around diagnosis and staging of patients, and this is taking radiologic data or histologic data or even clinical metadata taking patients and doing natural language processing on the electronic health record to come up with agnostic phenotypes within those groups of patients and begin to define specific subgroups that might behave differently. And so I think, there's a lot of promise in that. And I think I'm very excited about seeing, what these composite combinations of both biological data, clinical data, electronic health record data will bring in terms of bringing precision to our characterization of each individual patient.
Yeah. And then the flip side of that question is the unaddressed needs. And I think we've already sort of talked about one in the form of disparities, where a lot more focus is now coming. But from your perspective, on a research basis, what are the most pressing sort of unaddressed or under-focused on needs within hepatology?
You know, I think one of the big things that has always bothered me has been the fact that you know, in patients who have advanced fibrosis, regardless of etiology, the horse is in many ways is at least partially out of the barn. What I mean by that is that yes, we can reverse or prevent some of the downstream complications if we can address the underlying etiology of that fibrosis. But in many instances, there are still residual risks for disease yep. progression and even cancer development. And I think, I think what we still need is an ability to, because I think one area that will be hard to move is to really, at least immediately, will be to roll back that fixed scar mm-hmm. and fibrosis in so many of these patients. And so I think that with these patients, you know, we can't transplant everybody. It's just way too resource and capital intensive a solution for not only patients with advanced fibrosis, but certainly even those with liver cancer. And so at some level, I think what we need to do is identify folks, who are at risk for advanced fibrosis or having established advanced fibrosis, to take them and identify those at risk for progression to decompensation liver cancer. And so I think it's, the ability to, again, prognosticate, to identify those at particular risk and then to apply, if you will, chemopreventive approaches, call them anti-fibrotic, call them anti-cancer or cancer chemoprevention. Regardless, I think the idea there would be to try to apply simple solutions that could, essentially forestall or even prevent those downstream complications in those patients, and I think this will be this is such an important area for those patients who have established liver disease, for whom transplant is not either available or will be available to them as a solution. We've got to be able to make a difference for them as well. So I think identifying those who are at highest risk for progression, and then preventing that using, say again, rational chemopreventive strategies, I think will make a great deal of sense, and I think is a big frontier.
Yeah, thank you.
So our final pivot is, since we're about a week away from the liver meeting as of recording this, wanted to ask you if you had to pick a couple sessions, one or two, that a trainee should not miss, which ones would those be?
Yeah, I think the ones that really electrify me the most, if I'm a trainee, I would say, first and foremost, don't miss the academic debate.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a favorite. Yeah.
You know, it's just, it is, it's got everything. It's got an important set of questions, relevant questions, contemporary questions that face us as practitioners, and have essentially two teams of well prepared, articulate, thinking on their feet clinicians marshaling arguments for and against a very debatable subject, and making their case to the audience. So it's a great education in terms of just a topic review, a description of the issues, and of course the case for a particular approach to those issues, between two sets of trainees who are, again, mentored by a senior faculty member, and it's magic that happens there. You can't not be interested in that. It is so so much fun, everybody's a winner in that. The participants themselves, the judges, and all of us in the audience just all come out of that just profoundly elevated by that. And I think as a trainee, you can see, the passion people have for the medicine, for the questions, and for the idea of defending their ideas, it's just, it's fantastic. And you know, trainees would just be completely turned on to the field and to the debate format and to being, they want to be part of this when they catch one of these sessions. And you know, it's infectious, no doubt about it. In terms of any others, I mean, the postgraduate course, I think, is another mm-hmm. just staple. It is state of the art. Lecturers giving topic reviews on a whole variety of themes. It could be a more sort of broad ranging survey of the field itself, or it might be a little more focused. Like this year's postgraduate course is really around fatty liver disease, both alcohol and non-alcohol versions of it, which I think is obviously a major sweet spot for us as a field. And so I think that's really going to be a dynamite course and one that that no trainee would ever really want to miss. They will know hepatology when they sink their teeth into a course like that.
There you go.
And then, putting the trainees aside, any session that you're personally particularly excited about?
Yeah, there's going to be a research workshop on a clinical research workshop on artificial intelligence, which I think is going to be fantastic. I mean, because I made comments on this a little bit earlier about the increasing role of AI in our lives as both clinicians and as researchers, and I think that we're going to have to wrap our arms around big data, and I think it's incredibly important for us to be familiarized with the themes, both the strengths and the limitations of what AI can do, and then applying it to our practices, whether that's in terms of refining our ability to read pathology or to read images. I think those would be two excellent examples of using AI in our diagnostic lives, for instance. But as well, even using AI on natural language and our health records to identify patients who might be a distinct sort of subtype or subphenotype of a disease or behaving differently, or unique candidates for clinical trials at another level. But I think that it's here to stay, and I think it's very important for us to become more fluent in that area to understand what it can and can't do for us. And I might also add that this year's president's lecture is John Halamka, who is director of the Mayo Clinic platform and a nationally recognized expert on AI and its application to clinical medicine. So he too, and that talk should also fit in nicely with this theme. And so I'd encourage that as well.
Awesome. We're really looking forward to it. And we're really looking forward to now the lightning round.
Yes.
So we're going to, the easy part's over. Now's the hard part of this interview.
That's right. That's what they say.
That's what they say. So we're going to ask you a couple really short questions and just want you to say, whatever pops into your mind. And so are you ready?
Okay. Fire away.
He looks
away.
Ready. Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely
ready as I'll ever be.
Are we ready is the real question. So I want to ask you about if you could name or describe a time where luck played a role in your career.
Yeah, I would say right at the beginning of my training in GI hepatology. I alluded to it briefly, but when I was getting going, I was trying to figure out, I just finished my clinical year of GI fellowship. I enjoyed doing liver disease. And then there was this, there were a couple of paired discoveries that, as it turns out, both eventually would end up earning the discoverers the Nobel Prize. I mean, the first was, as I alluded to, the discovery of hepatitis C as the causative agent of mm-hmm. non-A, non-B hepatitis. And the second was actually the discovery of PCR, polymerase chain reaction. And so I was trying to sort out what I want to do for research. And So these two things converged, and I ended up, you know, starting off, you know, I had thought that, you know, I might be interested in possibly doing something based at the bench, but I wasn't committed to that. And I also thought I wanted to work in patient-oriented research. And so this actually gave me an opportunity, that first sort of set of events gave me the opportunity to actually to you know, to dive into work essentially doing at the time was HCV RNA assays on a bunch of stored clinical specimens of patients who had, you know, varying risk for non-A, non-B hepatitis. So to look at hep C. And so you know, that's how I became super interested then in not just hepatitis C and its initially seroepidemiology, but then wanting to do much more. That is to mm-hmm. say, I wanted to dive deeper. And so the luck part of it, I think, was you know, that those things converged to create a kind of a new area for research, mm-hmm. And then as fate and environment would have it, there was an environment for me to start doing some virology and molecular biology around the virus itself, and really kind of, you know, dig deeply into viral pathogenesis, persistence, and interactions with the host, and so that became the basis for the next many years that followed in a research career. So that was the luck of the confluence of those events creating that opportunity.
I'll just have to look out for what Nobel Prize is won in a hepatology related field in the next year or so. And but,
yeah, this
is finally my niche.
This is really along the lines of Pasteur's chance favoring the prepared mind, you know, sort of, mm-hmm. you know, if You keep your antenna up, and you know, and to take new developments wherever they fall, and to begin to, you know, think about applying them to, you know, to perhaps some of the important burning clinical questions that have been on your mind for some time. And I think I would give that advice to anyone, yeah. to always keep your mind open to what new things pop up.
Yeah. All right, well, we only have two more questions in the lightning round, and we promise these are faster. So what was the last TV show or series that you watched?
Let's see. The last TV series I watched was actually, because everyone else has been watching it, is The Squid Game.
Yes, yes. Indeed. And now let's spend the next 15 minutes discussing Squid Game.
I think it gave my fiance nightmares for a week.
Yeah,
It
certainly was disturbing in its own right.
Yes, indeed.
And our last question for you is very simple. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite liver cell?
I'd have to say. I mean, this is the vanilla answer. I'd still have to say the hepatocyte. It's the target cell of all the viruses that I have studied over all of these years, and it's the cell that becomes transformed into you know, hepatocellular carcinoma. But I would have to give a close second and even a third to the stellate cell and the macrophage or Kupffer cell, insofar as they are so critical in really promoting the real disease of fibrosis. But I, if you had to pin me down, it would still have to be the hepatocyte.
All right. Dr. Well, Raymond Chung, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was
this
real
is great.
Honor.
Alex, Adam, thank you guys for a wonderful show and a wonderful format. So continued success with your great work.
Thank you.
And we're back. It's now segment three, and we're going to do...
Segment three.
The segment three jingle has been rung, and we're going to do a little bit of talking about the liver meeting. We'll start by... I just want to plug a panel that I'm going to be on Sunday, November 14th, during the liver meeting. It's at 9 a.m. It's located on the internet, so hopefully you can join me. I'm going to be doing a session with Dr. Danielle Brandman from UCSF. We've alluded to this previously on the podcast, but I spent some time along with the Training and Workforce Committee from ASLD revamping the transplant hepatology fellowship application process. And this session is basically going to be an explainer for how to apply and the changes that we've done to hopefully streamline and make the process a bit easier. I'll also give some of my own advice for applying from my own experience and others' experiences who I've had the pleasure of talking to. So it's called The Nuts and Bolts of Applying and Becoming a Transplant Hepatologist in the United States. It's Sunday, November 14th. It's at 9 a.m., and it'll be right there at your computer. So pour yourself a cup of coffee if you're interested in learning a bit more about the application process, and spend 45 minutes with me.
There's nothing better than spending time with Adam, since I do it frequently. But I think this is a great session, and as I've said before, when you first sort of broke the news about this on the podcast, this is a necessary and really exciting change for transplant hepatology. Both of us applied in the free-for-all era, and it was sort of a mess and didn't necessarily lead to the most equitable outcomes for probably everybody overall. And so I think credit to ASLD for making this change and really investing the time and money for this. And I even though I have already accepted a position somewhere, I think I'm also going to join just because this is such a great initiative and I can't wait to see you on the big stage.
Yeah, I'm really proud of the work that was done. You know, I had a very small role to play, but the workforce committee really took these concerns seriously. I think the program directors were kind of getting fed up with it as well. And so there was a lot of momentum and really kind of settled on something that I think is going to be really, really helpful and a really, really progressive solution that I think is only going to get, you know, even easier and better for everyone in the future. And so come check that out if that's of interest to you. And then, Alex, what is your poster? What are you doing?
Yes, well, thanks for mentioning it. It's looking at the role of aldosterone antagonists in the development of hyponatremia in patients with cirrhosis and ascites. And this has been a real labor of love over the last sort of year and a half,
aren't
2 years. It's true. But if you've never done a retrospective pharmacoepi study, you've really never lived, is what no one has ever said. The real goal with this was that I think all of us see a ton of patients in the hospital that have ascites. They're on some dose of diuretics, often a 2-to-5 or 5-to-2 ratio of furosemide and spironolactone, and they're hyponatremic. And the question is sort of what to do at that point, or is there potentially a way to prevent that? Our hypothesis was that it wasn't the furosemide. It was much more the aldosterone antagonist driving the hyponatremia. We've certainly seen more hyponatremia in general populations with spironolactone than furosemide. And the idea is that in, you know, patients with liver disease, you've got a jacked up ADH, and then you've also got a jacked up renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. And when you give spironolactone, you knock out the sodium retention, but you still have all the free water retention from the ADH side. And so this can cause worsening hyponatremia. To make a long story short, and with all the caveats of retrospective pharmacoepi studies and the bane of my existence, which is confounding by indication, we were able to look at a large group of people that were started on both at the same time and then look to see if the dosages of one or the other were more likely to lead to, in a sort of retroactively prospective direction, cause hyponatremia. And our data, I think, is quite compelling to suggest that it's definitely not furosemide. If anything, furosemide may be slightly protective, in that there's a very strong signal that aldosterone antagonists actually do increase the risk of development of hyponatremia. And so long-term, obviously more prospective, bigger studies need to be done, but it may be time to start rethinking this 5-to-2 ratio that is based on almost nothing.
Very, very interesting and very clinically relevant topic. So be sure to check out Alex's poster and be sure to check out the next episode of Liver Talks.
Yes. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, shout out to Andy Coyle. And enjoy the meeting. We hope to meet some of you a year from now at the liver meeting that we believe is in
Washington, D.C.
The Washington, D.C.
And if anyone wants to bring us to dinner at Rasika, you haven't. We are RSVPing 1 year in advance.
Yes. It's a yes.
It's a yes.
Bye, Adam.
Bye, Alex.